Accession number 9428, Reel 3.
Mr. Keel, Reel 3. Could you tell me about any special training that you had whilst you were...
Training? Of what sort? Training as a soldier, or training as for one of the jobs in the army?
Yes, that's right. For one of jobs the special in the duties, army. Yes.
Yes, well, of course, there's so many. Amongst them was, I discovered very early on, was a batman. That is, all officers were allowed a servant. And I know I was on parade on that very early days when the sergeant on parade said, well, listen, men, is there any men here who were valets or valets, as they called it, valets in civil life? Well, I knew what he meant. Valet was a valet or a man who looks after another man. So me, anxious to escape from that bloody parade ground, up went my arm, not knowing what it was all about. I wanted to escape. So up went my arm, and I was interviewed by the officer, and I told him, I said, well, sir, I know very little or nothing about being a valet, but if you tell me what to do, I'll be most happy to do it. So I became the officer's servant. And we must have been in a brick building then, because I know I'd got a very nice, what they call it, they used to call it a kitchen, which I could sleep in. There was a truckle bed there, and... I could make my officer cups of tea and things like that, and clean his boots. And, well, I was very happy there, and I used to look out of my window at my company. They were all on parade and doing all these physical jerks and things, and I just sat up in my window and watched them. Well, after a week or two, I thought, well, really, I ought to go and join in with this. I'm in this army. I should know what this army's all about. So one day I wandered down into this one, which I knew was my company. I fell in, and it came to a roll call, you know, and anybody's name not called out? I said, mine, sir. What's your name? Keel. Don't belong here. Hop it. So I hopped it and back into my room. And a couple of days later, I went down again, and I was slung out again. They don't belong to us, you've been... So, all right, another bunch over there. So I tried them, and they Keel, don't belong to us, op it. So of the three, I was told to op it. So I didn't trouble until the fourth mob. They went down there and said, you've been down once or twice to the other company. What is your name again? I said, Keel. Well, what are you doing here? I said, I'm an officer servant. Where? I said, for Captain Bellingham. Lieutenant Bellingham, up there. Well, he said, why haven't you been on parade? I said, I haven't been asked to come on parade. I've asked me to look after him. And so that's how the army rediscovered me. So I had to go on parade every day and clean his boots in between times. So...
Could you perhaps just tell me what your duties were for Lieutenant Bellingham?
Well, I was cleaning his boots, making his bed, Well, everything. Where an officer has got to be looked after, his trousers pressed, we'll say, and his shirt and his laundry, everything that a wife would do for a man, the batman had to do for his officer. So that's what it is. You could call it a housewife.
How did you feel about that job?
That was all right, because I was off parade, and I got my nice little room on my own. I was satisfied, yes. It wasn't until...
How did he get on with Lieutenant Bellingham?
He was a very nice man. Very nice man. Yeah, didn't have much to say to him. You know, as long as everything was all right, as far as he was concerned, he didn't worry about me at all. But, as I say, I don't know how... it must have been on parade that particular day when, again, the sergeant said, "Now we've got a form. Is there any man in this platoon who's a musician in civil life?" Up went my arm. I wasn't a musician, but I had learned how to blow a post horn. I don't know whether you want the story of how I learned to play.
Please do.
You'd like that, would you? Well, when I was with my horses at Drury Lane Theatre, we used to be able to supply anything for any show for the stage or whatever, spectacle. Gardner Hales could supply the animals and men for it. Well, in came one day a job to advertise for the Anti-Vivisection League. Anti-Vivisection League. And then what they wanted was a miniature glass carriage with a team of miniature ponies and a coachman dressed a la Lord Mayor's coachman with cocked hat and feathers and knee breeches and things like that, and a post-horn blower at the back of this glass carriage. Well, we could supply all those things except the post-horn blower. You know, they said, anybody here, anybody amongst us can blow a post-horn? No, nobody could. But I knew about a post-horn. A pal of mine had two in his... They were carting contractors. And in his hall, he used to have two post-horns on the wall. And I thought, oh, that was all right. I could soon learn to blow one of those. So I went to see him, and I said, could you not loan me one of your post-horns? He said, why? I said, well, we've got this thing where we've got to go around London advertising the Anti-Vivisection League. Well, he said, you can't blow anything, Tommy. I said, no, but I think I could soon learn. Yes, he said, but he's not going to learn on one of mine. He said, if you put the wrong amount of air through a brass instrument like that, which are very old and fragile, he said, you can bust it, you can crack it. So he said, take my tip, go away, find yourself a bit of gas pipe. It's about, you know, a foot long or 18 inches long. A bit of gas pipe, he said, that'll do just as well. He said, and learn to purse your lips over one end of it and go as if you were spitting a hair off your lip. He said, until you can make a noise, and then it, when you can make a noise going through it, try and do tentivy, tentivy, tentivy. So, okay, I found myself a big gas pipe, and I found in a very short time I could do tentivy, tentivy. So I went and borrowed one of his horns because I said, listen. Oh, he said, well, that's all right, and you will borrow it, but very carefully. So we were all set, and away we went all around London, and I was tentivy, tentivy, tentivy. Lovely, you know, all our penny coachmen. Very happy doing that. And so when it came to the army, and they said, any musicians here, I suddenly remembered my coachman business. So I said, me, well, what do you play? A brass instrument, sir. Brass instrument, all right. Well, fall in, blah, blah, blah. You are now a bugler. I say, right, so you turn up for bugle duty every morning and learn all the calls.
Yes, could you actually stop there for a moment and say, were you given actually any training to play the bugle?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. Yes, your bugle corporal, a bugle sergeant, would show you how to and make the noises of when it is, and then you would practice what he'd show you, he'd do that, and you see, you tried. No, until you get that, and then you go on to the next call, and weeks after you had learnt all the calls.
How many calls were there?
I couldn't tell you. There's a lot of them.
Can you give me some examples of what the calls were for?
Yes, there's cookhouse.
Can you remember what the cookhouse call was?
Come to the cookhouse door, boy. Come to the cookhouse door. That's the cookhouse. Yeah, yeah. And orderly sergeants is... officers call for mess. Officers' wives get puddin' and pies. Officers' wives get puddin' and pies. The men they get skilly. That is the officers' mess. Sergeants was... No, I can't remember. But anyway, quite a number. There's two or three of them there. But I progressed through all the calls, and I learned every call. And I evidently was proficient, because came the great day when I passed out from sergeant as a regimental bugler. And we were under canvas again. Whether it was Aldershot or whether it was, I don't know, but we were under canvas, because I remember walking round the tents very proud of myself with my lovely thing and my bugle at my side, and the all of a sudden Sergeant Major's voice, "Bugler! Yes, sir? Bugler, play, call ordinary sergeants." "Yes, sir." Ooh, panic came. Stage shock. "Bugler! Yes, sir. Blow ordinary sergeants." "Yes, sir." Oh, what the hell? Oh, what is it? My mind was blank. I could not. And then again, the voice, very cross this time, "Bugler, will you sound ordinary sergeants?" I said, yes, sir, right away, sir. I'm trying to find my mouthpiece. Says a mouthpiece should be in the bloody trumpet. Blow ordinary sergeants. Well, I was more staggered than ever, and I put bloody thing up to my mouth, and whatever came into my mind, I blew. And nobody will ever believe it. What I blew was the fire call. And from everywhere, out of every tent, and for every nook and cranny, people all merged to this assembly point for the fire. That must have been the end of my bugling days, because I never remember having a bugle ever after.
Do you remember what happened to you?
I can say that they don't send that bloody man back to duty. I can see them saying that. That was it. But I knew all the calls.
Fine. Did you have any other special duties?
No, that came to the end, because after that, as I say, anything to get away from ordinary regimental duties, that is when they said, "Did anybody speak any foreign languages?" I speak a very passable French. In fact, they used to say I was almost fluent at one time in French and the French patois of the Pas-de-Calais district and whatnot. And I said, "I have also lived in Germany, and ich kann Deutsch sprechen. Ich habe in Deutschland gewesen. Haben Sie in Deutschland gewesen?" "Nein." "Oh, Deutsch ist ein schöner Platz." And they thought it was good. And so they said, "Well, there's some jobs going when you're not exactly a spy, but you are allied to that. Because we still have a lot of foreigners still in England, and the job is to root them out. So a certain number of personnel will be in disguise or civilian clothes and muck about in bars and listen in on here, and just listen in if they can hear any foreign languages, and then try and decipher what it is, and then give an eye where they're going to or where they've come from, and do that. You're a sort of spy." So I thought, that's just what I want. So all the jobs that came along, the transport, which I wanted, they'd got horses, so I wanted to join. I applied to join the transport, being an ex-rider, and they said, "No, you can't do that. You're down here listening. Sorry, we can't accept you." I must have opened my trap that nothing came of it. I must have said to somebody, "Oh, aren't I lucky? I'm going to be a spy. I'm going to listen in to..." I must have said that to the wrong person. Consequently, because I was told always to be already packed up, all my gear always packed up, ready to go away wherever I was sent. And of course, I opened the trap, and I never went on there. Consequently, I couldn't join the transport. And by the time I could join the transport, it was too late. They'd got all the personnel.
What did you think about that job? Were you excited for it, looking forward to it?
I would have been very excited about it, yes. Yes, it would be nice to listen in and, you know, and then trace it back. Where he came from and that. And then try and get in conversation. Bist du Deutscher? Nein, bist du Deutscher nicht? Oh.
Did they actually try and teach the techniques of listening?
No, they didn't. They just said, you will listen in. We'll tell you later. But you'll be already packed up to go away when we tell you to go or where to go. So nothing ever came.
Fine. To just stay with life in the camps a little longer, can you remember what form the daily routine of the camp took in terms of when you got up in the morning and what happened next?
No, because I can't say that every day was the same. Every day would be something different. You get up in the morning, you wash, shave, clean, already have breakfast, and then out on parade, and whatever the parade was, I don't know, rifle practice or marching or whatever the duties was for that morning, you were on parade for that. Come back with lunchtime, afternoon, you're out again on parade for whatever duty is laid on. And that's all it came evening, and evening is cleaning up your buttons and your boots and whatnot and get all ready for tomorrow. That would be the day.
Mm, yes. What time would you get up in the mornings?
I couldn't tell you. I should think somewhere around about six, I should think. I can't remember, you know.
When you were bugler, was it your job to sound the reveille?
I never even got to it, boy, before I could even get on duty to blow reveille or lights out. I was sunk. I was chased out of it. I knew all those calls.
I see. And
I very often hear them on the watchdog. I can go right through it with them. Last post and all that. I can do it. I know it. After all, what is it, 40, 50, 60 years, I can still remember all those, but I couldn't remember that day.
Can you remember what arrangements were made for eating at the camp?
Well, there were so many different camps. As you know, I'm very non-committal about that. If you were in barracks, you'd have a proper dining hall. I can't remember seeing any plates. And yet dimly I can see a plate, which you'd have to take outside and clean with dirt. But I think most of the time we used to use our personal canteens, which is the first part is like a little saucepan, and the other part is shallow, and the bottom part used to be for, we'll say, stew, or I'll say roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. But anyway, the bottom part was for the main meal, and the top part, which is shallow, used to be for sort of pudding. But that's all I can remember about how we used to eat, but I'm certain it was the canteen that we used to eat from. Because I can always remember cleaning the canteen, and the best way of cleaning it was outside to get a bit of dirt and a bit of paper and make some wet soil and rub it, and it brings it all up nice and shiny. That's as far as I can go, because as I say, it's so long ago that it's so easy to forget.
How many meals were you given a day?
Well, it would be a cooked breakfast of some sort, and it would be a cooked lunch. But as far as supper goes, I can't remember. Then again, maybe in those days there was a canteen, the EFC canteens, that's touched the chord, the EFC canteens. They were in England before EFC Expeditionary Forces canteens. You could go there and get a hot cup of tea or something, a hot sausage roll or something. That were the canteens. So it's possible that you got a bit of bread and cheese in your army dining hall, but if you wanted something better, you'd go and buy it at the EFC canteens. And that's as far as I can remember about food.
Mm-hmm. You say better. What made you say that, do you think?
What?
When you said if you wanted something better, you would go to the EFC.
Well, for supper, for instance, I don't suppose the army would get their chefs working for three hot meals a day, so he would probably cut up lumps of cheese and lumps of bread and dump it down and you go and help yourself. But the canteen, which was their livelihood, they've got to make money, so they would make hot meals, sausage rolls and things like that, where you've got to pay for them, however small, but it would pay them to put on semi-warm food.
Who worked in the EFC canteens? Were they civilians?
They were civilians, yes.
Can we just leave the food side for a moment and look at the washing and latrine facilities that existed?
Yeah.
Can you remember what was provided for you?
Yes, lovely cold water to wash in. Once, I don't know whether it was once a week or once a month, we'd have a bath. But there again, it was It was a parade. Didn't feel like bath night at all. You know, you parade in the nude, one after the other, in and splash about and out and get dressed again. That was a bath, but I can say...
You actually used the water that someone else had used previously.
I couldn't say it was the same water. I couldn't say that, or whether it was showers, I don't know. But for mornings, for the ordinary wash and shave, I can see the taps, long rows of taps and bowls, and it was. I don't remember it ever being hot water, cold water when you shave, standing at a thing, get it over as quick as you can because it's bloody cold standing there.
Mm. Was that out of doors where that took place?
Well, somewhat a semi a roof to it, but I'm not going to say nicely undercover. As far as I can remember, it was a roof, but open sides.
Mm. Were you provided with shaving equipment and so on? Did you have
No. That you're issued with those things. It's the first time I ever had a shave with a cutthroat razor, and it was a cutthroat all right because I cut my bloody face to pieces with it. And I must have got on with it for a little while because eventually I know I got a safety razor. But we were issued with cutthroat razors and brush and thing. But a lot of chaps like the cutthroat thing, but I couldn't get on with it. Not to this day. I have tried it once or twice in late years and couldn't get on with it.
What about the latrine arrangements?
Again, depends where you were. If you were in a proper camp, we'll say, like Aldershot, well, there'd be proper canteen, proper latrines with proper seats and proper doors and proper ones. But get away from there and it would be the old bar where proper seats cut out, you know, a man sitting, not, you know, sitting next to each other on these things with proper round things to sit on. And there was no privacy, it was all. And everything that you did would drop down into these tubs and they would be taken away daily and buried. I can remember being on duty once. I don't know where. As a policeman, because men were getting lousy in those days, and you had to see that they didn't unpack their shirts that had got lice, or take lice out, and because some of them used to find lice and put them on the wooden plank where they were sitting and crack it with their thumbnail and then find another one and crack again. Well, that was against the law because you could even easily leave behind a few nits or a few live lice which could be picked up by the next man and make him lousy as well as the other one. And it was a crime, and that they'd be put on a crime if they were caught doing it. And I can remember being a sort of regimental policeman to stop that.
Well, you had to actually stand inside the latrine to observe what was going on.
Yes, something like that, yeah.
Not a very pleasant duty, I would
think. I was just going to say that.
Was it a punishment?
I can't remember if they got a punishment, but...
No, I meant a punishment for you.
No, it was just something to take me away from the duties that it wasn't necessary, to put me somewhere where it was a necessary duty, I think.
You mentioned this outbreak of lice. Was this quite common in the camps, do you think?
Well, not in the early days, but a little later on. I mean, you might get men who'd come back from the front and they would be put into your battalion, perhaps for training or to train others. But they might have been at the front and they might have brought a few lice with them. And it's remarkable how quickly lice will grow into more lice. So they could have easily have brought in some, and somebody else picked up some. But anyway, apparently the army were conscious that lice were in existence, and that it had to be stamped out about them, people squashing them in public. That's all about all I know of it, except that I was told, see that they don't pull lice off themselves and crack them.
Was there any attempt to actually clean up the troops who had lice? With a
I don't know whether it was a medical order. I couldn't tell you, with the doctors or I don't know. You know, there's so many things goes on a battalion of 1,000 men that you don't know everything that happens, except that it just to do with you personally at that time. But so many things went on.
Yeah, did you have lice while you were in the camps?
In the early days of France, mouldy, lousy stink. Yes, lousy.
But not while you were in England.
No, not in England, no.
No.
But I had lice all the time I was in the trenches and out of the trenches until I joined the concert party. And then I got free of all those things because I could have my own underclothes and all that I had. But up until then, it took a lice, I think.
We'll talk about that
when we
come to the actual Western Front. Looking at your training now, looking back on it, do you think your training was adequate for the task you had to complete on
no,
the Western Front?
No, not really, no. They had so many thousands and thousands of men to ship over to the German side of the world who were fully trained, and they had been trained for years. And we had to be thrown into it, and the minimum of training to put us in the field. No, we went fully trained.
Did you feel that at the time?
No. We thought we were the cat's whiskers. We thought we knew it all. We didn't.
You mentioned just a moment ago that men came back from the front. You said they might well have brought rice.
Oh, yes.
With them. Did they bring news of what the battles were like?
Well, we talk amongst ourselves, but whether we believe them or not, I don't know. And I can't remember ever talking to any of them, to be quite honest. No.
Did you talk amongst yourselves about what France would be like?
No, couldn't, in England, before we went over, we couldn't wait to get over. We wanted to get there. We wanted to be in the war. That's what we joined for. That's what we wanted. As I say, and when we crossed the channel, we got to the thing and we came down to the, where we were, we used to go in, the new troops out from England used to go in into a quiet sector. And the quiet sector at our place was Armentières, Mademoiselle from Armentières. That is where we went. It was a nice quiet war, and over the other side were a nice sort of enemy. They were the Saxons. And the Saxons, they were quite decent blokes. It wasn't until afterwards when the Prussians took over that they got a nasty war.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps, again, we'll leave the Western Front for the moment. We'll just stay in Britain and look at another aspect of perhaps the esprit de corps of the unit. Would you say that your unit had a feeling of identity, that you thought of the regiment and pride in belonging to that regiment?
Oh, yes. Ours was the only regiment in the world, of course. Oh, yes.
What was done to encourage that feeling, do you think?
Oh, I expect NCOs and whatnot to have pep talks to tell the men and we'd probably have lectures about the Middlesex Regiment. Now, the Middlesex Regiment in 17 at Albuquerque, when they did a lump to the Russians, you'd have pep talks about what happened in those years and the wonderful work that the regiment did. We used to get pep talks on that. So you were always full of your own regiment and anti anybody else's regiment.
Mm. Mm. And